we've been where we are now for 31 years. And when we arrived there, we arrived on the scene with the purpose of being committed to discipleship before anything else, because we saw that really as the central work of the church. That really is what I think ELF is all about. I mean, you're in the discipleship network. I'm working in the next room with another group of people who are in the discipleship network. This is really the heart of what all of this is about. And what I would love to see is people get a hold of the principles of discipleship, understand what true biblical discipleship is, and then just have it develop as a culture, that we would take what we learned, that we would reproduce that, reproduce. And when I say that, I mean not only among leaders, but among people in our churches, so that the leaders are examples of it, but then it filters down into the congregation so that the congregation begins to accept the very same things that we all do and begin to practice them. So you know, what you're talking about here is really the heart of what the Christian life is. It's the heart of the church's mission in the world, is to go and make disciples. And so we've struggled even in defining that in recent times. And, you know, we all have different ways that we do it and practice it, and there's latitude in all of this. But I think it has to be a deep conviction within all of us. And the trends in modern Christianity and in the church, I think, sometimes are given over more to activity than they are to true discipleship. And I remember we've all been influenced in some way by Dr. Schaefer and Edith Schaefer through La Brie. Many of us in this room have. Barbara, I think you said you became a Christian at La Brie, and back in before Mark was born. Long before he was born again, you know, I remember taking a course under Dr. Schaefer at Wheaton College. This was back in 1966, and the name of the course was Christianity and the Humanities, and it was 3 weeks long, and it went from Monday through Saturday, and it was 3.5 hours every morning, and I'd never met this man before. I'd heard about him. I remember sitting on the front row, and here at this man in these knickers and the little white goatee and all, I thought, this is very fascinating. But I was the one who became fascinated as time went on. And I was a pastor, a young pastor at that time. And he said two things that changed my life. He said a lot of things that helped me, but two things in particular that absolutely changed my life. And one was the statement that too many of our churches have become preaching points and activity generators. Preaching points and activity generators. Meaning that pastors spend a lot of time preparing for preaching, which is a good thing to do, but some of them end up only doing that. They're just preachers. And then, because we don't really do discipleship, a lot of times because leaders do not practice discipleship, we then have to come up with programs to supplement that. So we create all kinds of activities. We think by getting people involved in activities that somehow they're being discipled. They may be helped in some ways, but I think often true discipleship is lacking. And I think one of the most dangerous things about being a pastor is you may not be a discipler. You get so busy just doing things. So that's one thing that he said. And then another thing that he talked about that really changed my life and my wife's life was he used a term I'd never heard before, and it was pre-evangelism, doing pre-evangelism. Discipleship includes evangelism, maturation, reproduction. Those are all parts of it. And I was so glad I learned that when I was 25 years old. I heard that term used. And basically what it refers to is learning to love people, whether they're Christians or not. Loving your neighbor, loving the person at the grocery store. When I walk into the coffee shop, the person who's serving the coffee to me. Because everybody is created in the image of God. And everybody has value. And so human relationships really matter. In 1 Thessalonians, Paul says, I want you to grow and increase in love for each other and for all men. I was so busy in the life of the church, the only people I had time to love were Christians. And so Judy and I, my wife and I, wanted to create an environment in which we could engage with non-believers. And I was in a large church at that time, and we had Sunday morning services and Sunday evening services and Wednesday night services and board meetings. And I led a small group with a group of Christians on Thursday evenings. And we actually resigned from that church and started a new congregation that had a much more simple life to it, so that we could practice discipleship of training people. I went through several stages in my development from that time. This is back in 1966. I was 25 years old, as I mentioned. And then the other wonderful thing that we were able to do is we were living in a townhouse. Y'all know what a townhouse is? A flat. And right across from us was a lady. Her name was Judy Harding, and she had three daughters. She was divorced, and her husband had just left her with these children. And she was not a Christian. And it got to be Sunday evening. We didn't have a Sunday evening church service. We had a Sunday morning worship and teaching time. We asked people to be involved in small groups for discipleship. And Judy said to me, what are we going to do Sunday evening? And I said, let's invite Judy and her children to our house. So we popped some popcorn and we got some board games out and we started playing games. And they were like sponges. And they just soaked up this relationship. Well, we saw Judy and her children all become believers. And then they started coming to our church. So this fits into that pre-evangelism category of loving people who are around you. And so we began to try to practice that. And then we saw some other neighbors become Christians and some other neighbors. Well, after you do this a few times, you realize you've got to also invest in nurturing these people and bringing them to maturity. And so I started a practice back then of being very deliberate about putting groups of people together and training other people to lead small groups for the purpose of bringing people to maturity in Christ. Pre-evangelism is dealing with non-Christians, but then once these people make decisions, they have to have somebody who will take care of them. And I'm very struck by Jesus' words in Mark chapter 3, and I think it's verse 14, where it says Jesus chose 12 men that they might be with him, that he might send them out. And the word chose there is a very interesting word. Some of your Bibles will probably say appointed or ordained or whatever, but if you study the word, it's a really interesting word. It's a word used of artwork, and it can be translated, Jesus crafted a group. Jesus designed a group and put them together. One of the things my wife and I have learned over the years is to be very careful about putting groups of people together, thinking about how people are going to relate. There's an incredible group dynamic that goes on. I try to think of that first group with Jesus, got James and John, the sons of thunder, and he got the zealots and he put them all together and he began to work with them. The amazing dynamics that must have been present in that. And then that they might be with him. They were going to watch him and they, they didn't have the restrictions placed on them that we have in modern culture. They were pretty much able to spend days with him at a time. And we find them going to his house. We find them on the mountain. We found them in the sea. We find them in the boat. We find them traveling around with him. But that withness was really an important part of discipleship. And one of the questions I and some other gentlemen asked ourselves years ago, if I'm going to be a disciple maker, am I worth being with? Am I the kind of person that is worth being around? And so it became a challenge to think about character development. being the right kind of person. None of us will ever be like Jesus. He was the perfect disciple maker. But it is a call to character. It is a call to maturity. It is a call to take seriously obedience to Jesus Christ. And somebody said the other day here at the conference that what discipleship really is about is being obedient to the commands of Christ. And I don't think that's legalism, being obedient to the commands of Christ. I heard somebody say one time, the first duty of every human is not to find freedom, but to find your master. And who's going to be your master? You can think you're choosing freedom, but all you've done is choose a new master. So we've got to decide who our master is going to be, and then we have to grow in terms of what that means. And then it says that he might send them out. There are two things always in any successful church, successful organization, and that is it must be relationship-centered. It must deal with people development. There must be spiritual formation. These things must be going on. There's always a goal in mind, and that is the sending out part. And he sent them out, and they went out to reproduce what he did. Well, all of that to say that for me, I got in the habit, and I've been doing this for years and years and years now, and in our particular church that we're in now, we call it Zionsville Fellowship. I have a co-worker. You've met Eric Bobbitt. You know who he is. And about 20 years ago, Eric and I sat down because we'd been challenged by a statement we heard Hans Guinness make. And the statement was, and he was quoting a Native American who was observing religion in America. And the Native American said, it seems like Christianity in America is about 3,000 miles wide and about a half inch thick. And so Eric and I looked at each other and began to talk about that, and we said to each other, are the people in our church any different than that? And as we thought about that and discussed it, talked it over with others, we said, we're not really that much different. And what is missing? And so what we decided to do at that time is design a discipleship strategy or curriculum that we'd start using. And each of the pastoral staff would select six men. And my wife started doing the same thing with women, and she likes a group of about four women. And we decided that we would select a group of six men, and I'm still doing this, and work with them for 2 years. And we meet every week. You have to figure out the cultural barriers and all of those kinds of things. When would be the best time to do it? But the men that I meet with every Monday morning at 6 a.m. And we spend 2 hours together. And our curriculum takes us through three main areas. One is church history. We found that the knowledge of history in today's world is very bad. And so we call it the church and the development of Western culture, because we want to understand the cultural developments that have occurred. Then the second major area that we cover is theology. And then finally, the fourth one is worldview. How do you develop a Christian worldview? So we kind of create a framework with our study of history, go through a study of theology, and then we end up talking about Christian worldview. And as I said, we spend 2 years doing this. We do other things. We have a test that we give all our men called the style of influence, which helps you understand, you know, what kind of a temperament you have and disposition, what your strong points are, what your weak points. This is where you really start seeing some group dynamics come into play. Judy and I, once we form a group like that, and the others do the same thing, they invite all the husbands and their wives to our homes for dinner. We do this several times over the course of those 2 years. Each year we go away on a retreat. We take all the husbands and wives away for a weekend. We're there from Friday through Sunday, and we spend time together. And when I have ministry opportunities in different places, I usually try to select a man or two that I can take with me so that we are with one another. And I must say also, you know, the leader is always the learner, right? The leader is always learning. And one of the things my wife and I have come to talk about a lot is you need to disciple people for your own sake. If you want to grow to become a mature person, you have got to disciple other people. You've got to become responsible not only for your own growth, but for growth in others. You just have to do that. If you don't take that next step, you'll become stagnant and you will not grow. So we have responsibility for our own personal growth, but we must also take responsibility for others. Let me just insert something here. I do a lot of work with men, and I believe in that. I think we need strong male leadership today, and it's really been weakened. We also need strong development of women, both. But my experience has been often we see strength in women and weakness in men. And we've got to keep working in both areas. So we have a number of women's groups in our church devoted to helping our women grow, and the same thing with our men. And years ago, there was a book written by Stephen Clark, and it's called Man and Woman in Christ. This book was probably written in the 1980s, and Stephen Clark was a professor at Michigan State University. He was a sociologist. And he said, I want to show you my observation of five types of males that we find in our world today. And I like to give this because I still see the same thing at work in our world today. And so he talks about the five different kinds of males. And the first one he talks about is the macho male. And this is the male who has an overemphasis on his sexuality, his wrong interpretation of manliness. It's sort of the James Bond, John Wayne approach to everything is out there, and that's the way you go through life. And, you know, you encounter people like that in our world today. We have these models that are set before us, and so men think this is, you know, how you're supposed to live. The second one is what he defines as the feminized man. And the feminized man is not a homosexual, but is one who's taken on feminine characteristics. There are many different reasons for that, which I will not go into now. I'll advise you to get the book and read it, Man and Woman in Christ by Stephen Clark. The third, of course, is the homosexual male. And that's just a different interpretation of sexuality. Then the fourth is the passive male. The passive male. And I have to tell you that in my experience in working in the church, I've observed a lot of that. And the interesting thing about it is the passive male doesn't necessarily mean somebody who doesn't do anything. A passive male can have all kinds of interests, hobbies, sports, watching television, doing all kinds of things. But where the passivity comes in is in relationships. Does not initiate. Is passive when it comes to taking leadership or a nurturing role in a marriage or in a family or whatever. And then the fifth type of male that Stephen Clark describes is what he calls the responsible male. And the responsible male is the one who takes responsibility for his own growth and then assumes responsibility for nurturing growth in others. And I think the model that we have in the scriptures is that discipleship starts at home first, between husband and wife and with children. You know, when qualities of an elder are given in 1 Timothy, it says he must be above reproach, he must be the husband of one wife, he must be temperate. He must be given to hospitality. He must nurture his children. he cannot do these things, how will he lead the church of God? But then I think it's got to spill out beyond that. And we begin to assume responsibility for people on a larger scale, a larger area. So this idea of continuing to grow, nurturing, reading, studying, praying, all of these sorts of things are really good. But they've got to go beyond you. They finally have to get out where you are pouring your life into other people. So for the last 35 or 40 years, that's what I've been doing. And my role in the church, I have limited so that I actually have time to do these sorts of things. And as I said, it's a two-year curriculum. And then when I'm done, I expect some of the men to reproduce this, or they get involved in ministry in other ways. I have one man who has gone through this discipleship. And when I met him, he was not a believer. He came from a very strong Catholic background. He happens to be my neighbor two doors down. He and his wife was already a Christian, but he and his two daughters became believers. He had a landscape business in the Indianapolis area, but had a master's degree in education. And after he became a Christian, he decided to go back to teaching. And he teaches in the middle school in our town. And he has a small group of boys that he disciples. And he started a once a week meeting in the school where any kids who want to come can come. And they have Bible studies together. So it doesn't always mean they may reproduce exactly what we do. But they get involved in other. You know, first of all, just in nurturing the entire congregation, when you train people in this manner, you go through this kind of training process, and you have to realize, even though we have kind of a curriculum that we follow, the thing that's really at the heart of it is the relationship. And I'm always very aware of that and trying to develop relationships with the men that I have in my group. And I don't only meet with them in the group and have them for dinner. I go to places where they work. I go to their place of business, and I visit them there, and I have them show me through their work area. They know my life pretty well, but I want to know their lives, and I want them to know that I care about their lives. So that relationship aspect of it, I think, is really important. But then, you know, when you start going along and you get to know each other better and better and better, then your personal faux pas, your weaknesses begin to show up. And so you have to first realize the importance of being a model and an example of Christ, of getting the content across. But then there are also confrontational times. I mean, you have to be willing, as Jesus did, turning to Peter and turning to others and saying, you know, look, here are areas in your life that have to be addressed. And most generally, the ones that I have to deal with in the men's group have to be with men who've had more of a passive role in their marriages and in relationship with their children. And so then it becomes a matter of reconstructing that kind of a role. What's it going to mean for you? What kind of changes do you need to make in your life? And then as marriages begin to get repaired, families get better, and the whole church begins to be there. I think that's one of our biggest projects today, is to help people understand their humanity, what it means to be human, and to live in that humanness, to know how God made us. And sin robs us of all that. It takes all of it away. Other things that we have to deal with are issues of sexuality, you know, ethics, morals. I don't know if that's what you're thinking of, Mark, but those are the kind of things that I seem to deal a lot with.
I'm Scottish, though, so don't hug me. There's two separate questions I'd like you to address, but they are related. So one is the kind of priority decisions that you must have made. So the expectations on a pastor or any Christian leader from the people that they're leading are almost limitless. So you must have a lot of disappointed people in your church.
Right.
Because you've said at some point, these six men are my priority, and I can't go around and visit everybody.
Right.
So that particular issue, I'd love you to address, because I think that's one of the really tough questions for all of us.
Yeah, high expectations.
Yeah, and then the second part is kind of related to it, that if you're spending about 2 years with people, now I mean that's your particular model. You're not saying that's right for everybody, of course.
Right, right.
There's a potential, at least, for some disappointed people after that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're finished with them. What now?
So
well, if you could address that.
Okay, well, yeah, I think, you know, the first thing you have to get in your mind is you can't do it all. You just can't do it all. And so it becomes very incumbent upon church leaders, pastors, teachers, whatever, to realize you have to pass the mantle on to other people. And I do think there's a particular way that the Lord has designed the church for this to happen, and that is through the growth of an eldership. Of raising up other men in the church. And going way back, when I first became interested in discipleship, I started discipling people for small group leadership. That's what I had in mind. We needed to have small group leaders. And so I started thinking of how that could be done, what would be required of people like that, how big should a group be, and all of these sorts of things, so that some of this pastoral care could be carried on in smaller groups. And then, as we began to get interested in church planting, and you know, we started a church in central Illinois, and then in the Chicago area, then we moved to Indianapolis, and we started a church there. Out of that church, we started three other churches. And so, what kind of leadership are we going to have? And so we became very interested in the biblical model of elders. And when we trained our elders, we told them that the responsibility was not only oversight, just general oversight of the church. It was also pastoral. They had to be shepherds. And they had to watch over the congregation. You know, it's like Peter says in 1 Peter 5, I'm a fellow elder among you, and I admonish you to shepherd the flock of God, over which he has made you overseers. So leaders must be willing to equip others and then let them do that. Let them have the responsibility and not try to do it all yourself. And so I think that's a culture that you have to build into a congregation of people. And so then for a period of time, there was a focus in my life where I was searching for men who seemed to have the qualities necessary for eldership. And so then in our elders' meetings, we talked about shepherding people, taking care of people. And you just have to do that, you know. And then whatever happens, happens. But I think for me the important thing is to know a biblical model and then follow that biblical model and be a trainer of other people. You got to train the leaders and then let them take responsibility for pastoral work, for counseling, for meeting with people, for encouraging people, for teaching people, and all of those sorts of things. Just those very qualities that are outlined. I think we take that 1 Timothy 3 passage and Titus 1 passage sometime, and we think it applies only to ordained ministers, and it doesn't. It applies to lay people. And really, the whole point of discipleship and the whole point of lay eldership or eldership is to raise the level of participation on the part of the laity, that they actually engage in real ministry. They're not just working on committees and doing things like that. They are actually engaged in entering into the lives of people and helping them. So my impression of the challenges that are faced here in Europe, and I would not profess to know all of those, but the impression that I have is there's a lot of tradition that has to be overcome. probably in some of the churches that have been around for a long time, there are probably cultural barriers that are there, just the way people see life and see the church and things of that nature. And then I think there has to maybe be a refocus of the church leadership to bring about some of those changes that you're talking about. And so, again, I think it goes back to not thinking, first of all, to realize this kind of training is needed. To get this training done, you need leaders. Thirdly, it's not going to be a fast process. It's going to take time. And I would try to think quality and not quantity. And so what that would mean for me would be to select a handful of people and start training those people. Whether you're women working with women or whether you're men working with men, but really focus on discipling people. That would be my thought. And I have traveled in Europe quite a lot, not so much in Eastern Europe. And I just know that, you know, you face a secularism here, probably a lot worse than we face in America, but we're moving in that very same direction and we're asking some of the very same questions. And churches within America, you hear about our mega churches and all of these sorts of things, but the churches have taken on entertainment mentality and a commercial mentality about them, and people really are not growing up in Christ. They're not really being discipled either. And where this is all going to go, none of us knows. But we have to be faithful, in the basic, very basic things. Yeah, well, that's a really good question. And I don't know that there's an easy solution to that. A lot of it would depend on how well you know people. Whenever we get ready to start new groups in our church, usually the pastoral staff sits together, and we do just, you said you have your co-pastor, and you talk about the different individuals who would fit well together. You know, who do we have here who could help this person over here? And we just talk about that. My wife and I often do that, you know, as we're having dinner together. And she's getting ready to start a new group. We talk about that. On the other hand, there have been times when we've just picked people and just put them together and, you know, say, we don't know. We're just going to start and see how things go. Again, I don't think they're hard and fast principles. I would suggest to you, if you haven't looked at this, the style of influence test that was put together by Gene Getz, who used to be a professor at Dallas Seminary, and Doug Wilson, I think, was the other one. And they put this together. You can go online and look at it. It's called an SOI, and it has 20-some different personality assessments. And I've taken this thing more than once, and every time it just nails who you are. And that might be an indication of the kind of people you would want to mix it up. So you don't have all of the same kind in the group, but that could even be a starting point. It's actually a very, very good tool that we use in our church. Yeah, how do we know when they're equipped? Yeah, we were over in the other group this morning. We were going through what does an equipped believer look like? And, you know, I think Mark has probably helped you all a lot with this. But some of the things that we try to look for in our discipleship ministry is things like this that I'm going to tell you are really set in place in a person's life. Number one, assurance of salvation. They are secure in their salvation and are able to articulate that, explain it to other people. The other is a comprehension of the Christian faith, that basic doctrines are solidly in place in a person's life. The idea of the matter of stewardship, they understand the stewardship of time, money, talents, and relationships. They steward all of those, or at least are beginning to steward all of those well. Their time, their money, their talents, their relationships. Love of the church. Obedience. As we said a moment ago, what does a real disciple do? He obeys Christ. That their home life is in order, or getting in order, that they're dealing with those kinds of things. And then lastly, there is developing within them a desire for reproduction, for getting involved in this culture of discipleship that we're trying to create. Reasons why you can't change, what would be the main reasons you cannot change the disposition or the attitude within the church. And part of it might be just what Mark mentioned there. They could be operating under the umbrella of a certain denomination, and the leadership in your own church is held captive to that constitution or that doctrinal statement or so. So you have to face that and realize that's the case. The other, that I thought of as you were talking there could be something as simple as a relationship. If I see the need for change in some way, trying to figure out how to get close to the leaders and show my love for them, my care for them, build a relationship and begin to have discussions. Because ultimately, that's what it's going to come down to, is having a dialogue over concerns. And if I were a pastor, I would want to hear concerns that people within the congregation have, and then see if we can't figure out a way to resolve that. And then, of course, you've just got the cultural barriers, the whole way that people see life. But we do have the tension always, don't we, of the older and the younger, and trying to work those together. I think having an intergenerational mindset as much as possible is a very good thing. And we tend to divide up our congregations into a whole lot of subgroups. And I like to see adults and children and youth all kept together. And one of the ways we try to do that in our church is in our worship time, all of us being together, in our adult teaching, preaching in the service, have as many young people in there and children in there as possible sitting and learning to relate to adults and having adults relate to them. I know a church in Indianapolis that I really respect, and they have their children starting at second grade sit in with the adults in for like an hour and a half of worship and teaching, and the children are learning to do that. So I just think one of the problems we have with our churches is we've created so many programs and subgroups, we divide everybody. Not a thing we do is we also have a family camp in the summertime, and we take all our kids and our adults and everybody and try to create a community.